10th of October, 2016. London was drizzly and overcast when Kitty arrived at Heathrow. She shivered and wrapped her green cardigan tightly around herself. There wasn't a chink of sunlight, just solid grey cloud cover, like a lid closed over the city. She missed the colours of Lake Acan Abbey. Even in wild weather, it had been like an artist's palette of pinks, purples, greens, reds, gold, and every shade of blue. She caught a train into the centre of town, then took a taxi to Crouch End, fumbling in the bottom of her case for door keys. There was a moment of panic. Tom wouldn't have changed the locks, would he? What if he hadn't gone to work yet, but was sitting at the kitchen table, or upstairs, still in bed? The door opened, and the first thing she saw was a neat pile of post addressed to her on the hall table. It felt as though she was an intruder. Everything was clean and orderly, and the air smelled of furniture polish. It was as if the house had been uninhabited since she left. She went to the kitchen and made a cup of tea, glancing into the fridge as she took out the milk. There wasn't much fresh food, but the freezer was full of ready meals, and that made her sad. Poor Tom. She dozed on the sofa for a couple of hours, then began to unpack the clothes she'd taken to America and lay out the ones she would take to Brno. As 6 o'clock approached, she had butterflies at the thought of meeting Tom, and smiled at herself. Would they make love that night? She arrived at the park early and stood beneath the shelter of an oak tree, wanting to watch Tom as he approached the bandstand. Even from a distance, she could tell he had lost weight. His jacket hung loose, and he'd forgotten to bring a raincoat or umbrella, so as getting soaked in the drizzle. But he was valiantly carrying 2 takeaway coffees, as well as his briefcase. She felt a pang of love for him. When she stepped out to say hello, she saw his eyes were rimmed by shadows. There was a moment when they both held back, then she leaned in to give him a kiss on the cheek, before taking one of the coffees. "You look tired," she said. "Are you okay?" She had done this to him. It was her fault he was so thin and grey. And then she remembered what he had done to her by sleeping with Karen. Suddenly, it seemed like ancient history, something that had happened in another lifetime. "It's good to see you looking all tanned and beautiful, Kitty Cat. Your summer on the lake obviously suited you."
"The cabin is gorgeous. You'll have to..."
She stopped. They weren't there yet. They sat on the wrought iron bench inside the bandstand, where hula hoop packets and iron brew cans littered the ground, and she took a sip of her coffee, a soya latte. He knew what she liked.
"You were right," she began. "There was a lot of work to do. It was covered in creepers and had a tree growing through the steps when I arrived, but it's all fixed up now."
She showed him some photos she'd taken on her phone. "I had to rebuild the porch and the jetty from scratch. I made that swing seat as well."
"What a beautiful spot."
He scrolled through the pictures. "So is that what you've been doing all summer? Working on the cabin?"
"I've also been finding out about the great-grandfather who left it to me. There are lots of gaps in his story, but I'm flying to the Czech Republic tomorrow to meet someone who can tell me more."
Tom looked alarmed, so she added quickly, "Just for the weekend."
"Will you come back to our house tonight?"
She had never heard him sound so unsure of himself. "I took my bags there this morning. Was that all right?"
"Of course."
They were like strangers. Kitty decided to cut through the formality. "I'm sorry I haven't been in touch. I needed space to think. Not just about us. I needed to try and work out what I'm doing with my life." She gave a little laugh. "I suppose I want to find a sense of purpose. Other people have children, and that gives them a focus, but we decided against them. Now I want to find a way for my life to mean something. Does that make sense?"
He was listening closely. "If you want to put the children issue back on the table, we can discuss it."
"No, not really." She looked into his eyes, trying to read his expression. "Unless you do."
"I thought about it this summer, but mainly because if we'd had kids, you wouldn't have been able to leave me for 3 months, without any communication. It's been horrible, Kitty. I felt as if I was emailing into a black hole, but I couldn't stop, because it was the only slender hope I had of getting through to you."
"Were you reading my mails?" She gave a guilty shake of the head. "I read your letter. It made sense." Suddenly she badly wanted to kiss him. It felt too soon, though.
"Are you still looking for a new job?"
"I had an interview last week with a company that raises funding for the arts.
and I just heard 2 days ago that I've got the job." He looked boyish in his excitement. "They're based in Shoreditch, in a converted factory. I love the atmosphere and the people there."
"That sounds brilliant. Congratulations!" She grinned at him.
"What will you have to do?"
He described the role, and Kitty thought how perfect it sounded for him to become an enabler for artists, someone who would help them achieve their dreams.
"Did you do any writing over the summer?" he asked.
She sighed. "Not a word. I'm beginning to realize I'm not cut out to be a writer. Sure, I can string a sentence together, but I don't have anything I passionately want to say. That's why I keep abandoning everything I start. My great-grandfather, on the other hand, he was a famous novelist in his day. His books are powerful insights into human emotion." He was regarding her affectionately.
"You never mentioned having a writer in the family."
"No one ever told me. I can't think why Mum never said."
"It seems odd, but I remember her saying she never met any of her grandparents. All four died before she was born."
"Did she?" Kitty screwed up her forehead, trying to remember. "But that's not true. Dimitri only died in 1986. It seems there was some big falling out between them. That's why Dimitri's inheritance eventually came to me. They couldn't find any family members when he died."
"Is this why you are flying to the Czech Republic? So you can solve the mystery?"
He smiled indulgently. "I'll tell you more about it over dinner. Can we go and eat now? I'm starving." They walked to their favourite restaurant, a tiny French bistro 2 streets from home, and first she told him what she had learned about Dmitri Yakovlevich. They ordered their usual, French onion soup, pepper steaks, and a bottle of burgundy, and never stopped talking throughout the meal. There was so much to say.
"If you have decided that you don't want to be a writer anymore, then what?" Tom asked.
"I don't know. I didn't get that far."
"If you want to develop another property, we could easily raise money against the house."
Kitty wrinkled her nose. "I don't know. It's stressful, and there are tedious problems. Besides, I'm not sure the market is going in the right direction. There could be a crash on the way."
Tom was watching her, eyes narrowed. "Show me those photos of your cabin again."
She handed him her phone, and he flicked through them once more. She'd taken long shots from the end of the jetty, and also some close-ups of the stairs and banister leading up to the porch.
"I know what you should be," he said, handing the phone back to her. "A carpenter."
She opened her mouth to object, then stopped. She loved working with wood. "But how would I earn a living at it?"
"That's up to you. You could set up a website and distribute leaflets offering to make bookshelves and fitted cupboards. Or you could design your own bespoke furniture. Why not?"
She frowned. "I'd need to upgrade my tools. I've already got contacts in that woodyard in Kentish Town. Perhaps I could build a shed at the end of our garden as a workshop."
Tom let her think out loud, nodding encouragement.
She had the strangest sensation as all the pieces slotted into place. It was as if it was predestined. This was one of the extraordinary things about a close relationship. It was possible for your partner to know you better than you knew yourself.
"Mum wouldn't have approved," she said. "She wanted me to be a lawyer." "Maybe. But most of all, she wanted you to be happy."
Kitty knew that was true, and loved that Tom knew it as well. He provided continuity in her life now that he had become her sole family member. She had drunk 2 glasses of wine and was about to pour another when she stopped, remembering her great-uncle Nicholas and his cirrhosis. Tom didn't want any more either, so they put a cork in the bottle and carried it home. Once they were in the hall, she grabbed the collar of his jacket and pulled him in for the kiss she'd been wanting to give him for the last few hours.
"I'm sorry," she whispered, and she meant she was sorry for leaving him alone all summer.
He didn't reply, too busy lifting her sweater over her head. She unfastened his trousers, lifted her skirt, and pushed her knickers aside, then stood on tiptoe and hooked one leg around his waist so he could enter her. "Now," she thought, "now at last I am home."
Chapter 60. Albany, New York State, 1955. Dimitri's double life continued for 7 years, and neither of the women he loved challenged him. Tatiana never seemed to resent the fact that he spent most weekends and holidays with his family, and sometimes couldn't see her for days on end. Rosa never questioned his whereabouts, just accepting whatever excuse he made to explain a few hours' absence. On the drive home from Tatiana's, he often stopped for a beer to clear his head. Guilt had become a familiar companion, but he still believed there had been no choice. He couldn't have left Rosa, the woman who had entwined her fortune with his and brought him so much happiness. But at the same time, he couldn't resist the potent magnetism of his decades-old bond with Tatiana. During those 7 years, both of his children got married. Nicholas had never brought home any girlfriends, and by his late 20s they were beginning to worry about him, until one weekend he presented a long-legged, sun-kissed Californian girl called Patty and announced they were engaged. The whole family flew out to Santa Barbara for a wedding in Patty's home church, followed by a party at her parents' glamorous beach club. At first, Dimitri and Rosa were dazzled by the champagne cocktails, the palm trees set around a turquoise swimming pool, and the glitzy people wearing ostentatious jewelry. But Rosa was soon circulating and befriending their new in-laws. She was wearing a rose-pink lace off-the-shoulder dress with a mauve satin sash and a tiny hat decorated with pink and mauve fresh flowers, and in Dimitri's opinion, was by far the best-dressed woman at the gathering. Marta had brought one of her many boyfriends as her plus one, a staid, prematurely balding Englishman called Stanley, who owned a company that manufactured silver cutlery. He had a strange accent from somewhere in the north of England, and Dimitri found it hard to make out what he was saying. After a while it became awkward asking him to repeat himself, so he nodded and smiled vaguely whenever they were forced to make conversation. Marta obviously had no such difficulty, because a few weeks after the Santa Barbara wedding, Stanley came to ask Dimitri's permission to marry her. Dimitri hesitated.
"Of course, it is my daughter's decision, but I hope you do not plan to take her back to England with you. My wife and I would miss her terribly."
"No, I'm going to be here a while," Stanley promised. "America's the fastest-growing market in cutlery trade, and we're most likely set up home near Albany."
"And you think you can keep my daughter and any children you might have in comfort with your earnings from this business?"
Stanley launched into a speech about profit margins and the potential growth of the company, and Dimitri stopped concentrating. He wasn't sure what Marta saw in this man, who was no more than average-looking, but perhaps she liked the foreignness of him. When he discussed it with Rosa later, she said he treated Marta like a princess, but Dimitri couldn't see how. At any rate, the marriage went ahead, in a church in Albany, followed by a reception for 80 guests in a swish restaurant. After the meal, a swing band played, and everyone crowded onto the tiny dance floor. Dimitri and Rosa held each other and swayed to the unfamiliar beat.
"We've done our duty as parents," she smiled. "Now I look forward to being a grandma."
The thought hadn't even occurred to Dimitri, and when he considered it, he felt sad that he and Tatiana had not been able to have a child together. His direct bloodline would continue into the future, but Nicholas and Alexandra's would not. Just after Marta's wedding, Dimitri's dog, Malevich, fell ill. His belly swelled up, and he was in obvious pain, pressing his head against the wall and whimpering. A vet was called, who told them the liver had failed, and there was nothing he could do. Dimitri held Malevich's head in his hands, looking into those trusting brown eyes, as the vet administered a fatal injection. Once the dog stopped breathing, he put his arms around him and sobbed into his coat. His head filled with images of all the friends he had lost, of his parents, of Tatiana's family. He thought of the concentration camps where many German friends had died, of the hard labor camps in Siberia. Why was life so relentlessly brutal, just one challenge after another? Why did evil so frequently triumph? For a while it seemed as though losing Malevich, the dog who had alleviated his depression at the onset of war, would tip Dimitri into another full-scale episode. The old symptoms returned, a feeling of uselessness, believing that there was no point in getting out of bed, or dressing, or shaving. Senator Joe McCarthy's subcommittee hearings to root out communism had begun to take on the repressive nature of the very ideology they opposed, and Dimitri feared he might be forced to leave America, the land that had become home. He went to Tatiana's house 2 or 3 times a week, but was taciturn and moody with her. When she tried to make him talk about it, he growled at her to leave him alone, and she shrank back, unprepared for this new side of him. but Rosa knew what to do. About a month after Malevich's death, Dmitri came home to find a Borzoi puppy scrabbling round the kitchen floor on unsteady legs. It leapt up at him, licking his outstretched hand, eager to make friends. The puppy's coat was white with brown patches, and it was only a few weeks old. He looked questioningly at Rosa.
"It's a girl," she smiled. "But she's not house-trained yet, so we're going to have our work cut out."
He crouched and let her lick his face as he ran his hands over the silky coat.
"Let's call her Trina," he said. "She looks like a Trina."
In his mind, he was thinking of the lady's maid who used to take messages between Tatiana and him when she was under house arrest. Tatiana was charmed when she met Trina, and pleased at the name Dmitri had chosen.
"I wonder what became of Trina," she mused. "I hope she found a good husband."
Dmitri didn't like to tell her it was unlikely. Most of the Romanov staff had been imprisoned, and several were executed by the Bolshevik regime. One sunny September day, when Rosa had told him she would be out until dinner time, he and Tatiana drove up to the lakes to take Trina for a long walk. Dmitri stopped at a remote spot on the shore of Lake Akanabi, and Trina ran into the water, taking to it instinctively. She never tired of swimming for the sticks they threw, bringing them back and soaking the two of them as she shook the water from her coat. They laughed to remember their failed efforts to train Autopo back in St. Petersburg. This Trina seemed either more intelligent or just more obedient than Autopo had ever been. The sun had already set when Dmitri dropped Tatiana back at her cottage and drove home, his forehead pink from the sun. He was late for dinner and hoped Rosa wouldn't mind.
"Sorry, darling," he called as he came in the kitchen door. "I was walking Trina and lost count of the time."
Rosa was sitting at the table, her head in her hands, and he could tell she had been crying.
"What is it?"
he asked, alarmed. Rosa never cried. She took a deep breath.
"I found a lump in my breast a few weeks ago. I didn't like to worry you because I was sure it was nothing, but I saw the doctor today and he says I have breast cancer. I have to start treatment straight away."
Dmitri sat down hard on a chair, the breath knocked out of him.
"You should have told me. You were depressed. I didn't want to add to it. But I'm going to need you to be strong now, Dmitri. Is that okay?"
He got up to put his arms around her, careful not to touch her breasts. He wondered which one the cancer was in, but didn't like to ask.
"Of course it is. How could you ever doubt it?"
She rested her head on his arm, eyes closed, and didn't reply. 2 days later, Dmitri accompanied Rosa to her appointment with the doctor who was treating her, Dr. Eisenberg. He was a bald man with freckles all over his shiny head, and he wore heavy black-rimmed glasses and a dark suit and tie. His manner was businesslike.
"I am recommending a radical mastectomy of the left breast, as is standard procedure. We'll remove all the breast tissue, the lymph nodes, and part of the muscle of the chest wall. That should excise all the cancer cells, but as a precaution we'll follow it up with a course of radiation therapy, which will start as soon as the wound has healed sufficiently."
His tone sounded as though he was reading from a textbook. He looked up.
"Any questions?"
"Yes," Dmitri said. "When will you operate? How long will Rosa be in hospital?"
"I have her booked in for next Monday, and I would expect her to stay with us at least a week."
"And the radiation? How long will that last?"
12 weeks is standard."
Dmitri counted in his head.
"So she could be cured by Christmas?"
The doctor sighed, almost imperceptibly.
"We don't talk about a cure, Mr.—" He consulted his notes. "Yakovlevich. We talk about being in remission, and I'm afraid Christmas is a little optimistic."
He talked on, and Dmitri listened hard, latching onto anything that sounded optimistic and memorizing the phrases so that he could reassure Rosa with them later, reassure himself.
"State-of-the-art technology. Gold standard therapy. I'd recommend the same for my own mother."
That evening they telephoned Nicholas and Marta to tell them the news, one after the other, and both insisted they were coming home to help look after their mother. Rosa protested a little, but gave in with a smile. She wanted her children by her side. Dmitri's first thought was that it would be difficult for him to slip out to see Tatiana with them there, but immediately he felt ashamed of himself. That was hardly the most important thing. The operation lasted 6 hours, and Dmitri was shocked to see how ill Rosa looked when she came round afterwards, her chest bandaged like an Egyptian mummy, and tubes draining fluid from her sides. It took all her energy to speak, and he ushered the children away after half an hour, realizing that she needed to rest. As they walked down the antiseptic-smelling hospital corridor, Dmitri looked at the dusty overhead pipes, the bright lights, the peeling paint on the walls, and knew they were going to become very familiar over the next few months. That evening they were all invited for dinner with Rosa's mother and sister, but Dmitri cried off, saying he had a headache, and drove to Tatiana's instead. She took him in her arms and ran her cool fingers through his hair, massaging his scalp.
"I got a book from the library about cancer," she told him. "It is important that she eats lots of good food to stay strong. The X-ray treatment is very successful, but it will take a lot out of her."
Somehow it seemed natural that Tatiana should be comforting him during Rosa's illness, helping him to present a strong front at home. She had never shown any jealousy of Rosa. Instead, she was curious about her, wanted to see photographs of her, asked about her likes and dislikes, her hobbies and volunteer work. Once she said that if circumstances had been different, she would have liked to be Rosa's friend. That was an odd thought, but Dmitri could imagine they would have got on. Rosa got on with everyone. Over the weeks and months of her treatment, Dmitri remained positive in front of Rosa and the children, but he was able to express his fears when he went to Tatiana's. Sometimes he cried when he described to her the agonizing burns the radiation caused on Rosa's already raw flesh. Often he talked through his worries about the side effects, the fatigue, the inability to taste food anymore, Rosa's tortured breathing when she finally managed to get to sleep, and his own sense of helplessness that there was little he could do. She had become so thin that clothes were falling off her, so he bought new ones in loose, soft fabrics, garments that could be slipped on and off without aggravating her wounds. He couldn't bear to watch while she changed or bathed, couldn't bear to see the jagged line where her left breast had been. He used to love her pert, shapely breasts.
"It will pass," Tatiana told him. "Life will go on."
As the new year of 1955 dawned, it seemed Rosa was in hospital more than she was at home. Things kept going wrong. She grew so tired she could barely get out of bed. Her blood counts were poor. She collapsed with a blood clot in her lungs. One day, when Dmitri visited, she clutched his hand suddenly.
"There is something I must say, and I want you to listen."
She couldn't raise her head from the pillow, but she sought his eyes, forcing them to meet hers before she continued.
"When I am gone, I don't want you to feel guilty about anything. I know you torture yourself with guilt for all kinds of things that were never your fault, but don't ever feel guilty about us. Please believe me when I say that I have loved our life together. You have been a good husband, although we never married."
She gave a little smile. Tears began to gather in Dmitri's eyes.
"Rosa, please don't talk that way. I want you to fight this thing and get well. You mustn't give up. We need you."
She reached for his hand.
"I don't think I'm going to beat this, my love. I'm too tired and running out of fight. But I can't bear to think of you being miserable when I am gone."
She took a deep breath that made a rattling sound in her throat, then said,
"Dmitri, I know you found her. I know you found Tatiana. And when I am gone, I want you to be together. And I want you both to be happy. Do you promise me you will?"
A sob burst from his throat, and the tears flowed. He wanted to say sorry, but couldn't even form the word.
"Promise me,"
Rosa insisted fiercely, her fingernails digging into his palm, and he gave a little nod. Chapter 61. Albany, New York State, 1955. Around 10 o'clock one February evening, a nurse rang to tell Dimitri that Rosa was very weak and unlikely to make it through the night. Nicholas and Marta piled into the car, and they collected Rosa's mother and sister, then drove to the hospital. Rosa was no longer conscious, but lay with her mouth open, gasping for every breath like a fish lying on a riverbank. They all spoke to her, told her they were there and that they loved her, but there was no reaction. She was too far along the journey to the next place. Chairs were brought, cups of coffee offered, and they sat with her as the breaths became fainter and further apart. Dimitri perched close to Rosa's head, whispering to her, wetting her cracked lips with a damp sponge, as he had learned to do after her bouts of vomiting. He felt panic welling inside him at the thought of life without her, but at the same time, he couldn't bear her to suffer any more. He must be strong tonight for the sake of his children. Marta was crying, and Nicholas was white-faced. Somehow they would get through this.
"You should take the wedding ring off her finger now," a nurse advised. "It's harder to do once she's gone."
Rosa's mother and sister glared at him as he slid off the gold band and slipped it in his pocket. They both knew, although the children did not, that there had never been a wedding. When the end came, none of them recognized it at first, because the breaths were already so far apart. They listened, scarcely moving a muscle, watching her throat for a tiny flicker. But after several minutes with no movement, Rosa's mother sobbed.
"She's gone."
A nurse came to confirm it and recorded the time of death as 3:20 a.m. Dimitri wanted to be on his own with her, to whisper his last private messages of love. But he couldn't. She belonged to all of them, not just him. He was dry-eyed, shocked, and extraordinarily tired. He failed to smother a yawn, and Rosa's sister shook her head and tutted. Before long, the nurse came to tell them that the body must be moved. That's what Rosa was now, a body. They trailed out to the car, and Dimitri dropped off Rosa's mother and sister, then took Nicholas and Marta back to the house. They were exhausted and went up to their rooms to sleep, but Dimitri sat at the kitchen table, head in his hands, feeling utterly bereft. He couldn't bear the emptiness, the terrifying hole Rosa had left in the universe. He wanted to cry, but at the same time was scared of crying because it might make him fall apart completely. On a sudden impulse, he got up and slipped out the back door, closing it quietly behind him. He climbed into his car, pulled out of the drive, and headed across town to Tatiana's, knocking on her door at 5 o'clock in the morning. She answered, wearing a long satin dressing gown, wiping the sleep from her eyes.
"She's gone,"
he said, a frog in his throat.
"I had to see you."
She pulled him inside and held him close for several minutes.
"I'll get some vodka," she said. "Sit down."
He took off his jacket, loosened his tie, which suddenly felt as though it was choking him, and kicked off his shoes.
"To Rosa,"
Tatiana toasted, handing him a shot of vodka. As Dimitri drank, he heard a banging on the door.
"Who can that be?"
he asked.
"I hope I didn't wake your neighbors."
Tatiana shrugged that she didn't know and went to see. He heard a voice in the hall.
"Where the hell is he?"
Then Marta burst into the room, her face scarlet from crying.
"You bastard! How could you? Mum's not even cold!"
She picked up a glass of vodka from the table and threw it over Dimitri. What could he say? He took a handkerchief from his pocket to wipe his cheek. Tatiana gathered her wits.
"You must be Marta," she said. "I am an old friend of your father's from Russia. Please sit down."
"Forget it. I'm not accepting a hospitality from a whore,"
Marta cried.
"Marta!"
Dimitri rebuked. He was too exhausted, too drained to deal with this. Marta was hysterical, spitting out her words.
Nicholas and I followed you in my car because I suspected you might come to your other woman. Oh, yes. I've known for ages. All those long walks with the dog, the mysterious errands and fictitious meetings. I warned Mom there was someone else, but she would never hear a word against you. All the time she was struggling with cancer, you were coming here. I just thought you might have the decency not to come tonight. Have you no respect at all?
Have a drink, Tatiana urged. You are overwrought. You don't know the facts, but we will explain if you sit down. I'll go and invite your brother inside.
You must be joking, Marta screamed. Sit down for a chat? In your house? Frankly, I never want to see either of you again.
She turned to leave.
Marta, wait!
Dmitri called and stood to go after her, feeling utterly useless. Tatiana put a hand on his arm.
Leave her. You can explain tomorrow when she has had some sleep and calmed down a little. Talk to both of them. I don't mind what explanation you give. It's up to you.
A few hours later, Dmitri drove home. He expected to find his children sitting in the kitchen over breakfast, but neither of them was there. Trina whined and nudged his leg, desperate to be let out to empty her bladder, and equally keen for her breakfast. There was a short note on the table telling him that both Marta and Nicholas had gone to stay at their grandmother's house. He sighed, imagining the character assassination that would be going on over that breakfast table. It would all come out now. How could he talk to his son or daughter with the disapproving in-laws present? He made the necessary phone calls to tell friends of Rosa's death, and spoke to an undertaker about organizing a funeral, then called his mother-in-law's house to consult them on the date. Neither Nicholas or Marta would come to the telephone, and Dmitri didn't know what to do, short of driving round and forcing his way over the threshold. Tatiana suggested that he write to them, and he did.
"We need to stick together to get through this terrible loss," he wrote. "After we have buried your mother, I will tell you anything you want to know about my long friendship with Tatiana. Be assured it is not what you imagine."
Worrying about the rift with his children stopped him grieving for Rosa. He went through the motions of ordering flowers, choosing a coffin, and picking hymns for the service, with only brief phone calls to his mother-in-law's house to ask their wishes. On the day of the funeral they made their way separately to the church, and when Dmitri walked in, he saw that his children, their partners, and Rosa's family had occupied the front row, forcing him to sit one behind. After the service they huddled together at the graveside, leaving no room for him, just glancing across red-eyed and accusing when the minister called Rosa a beloved wife and mother. From their sneering expressions, he suspected Nicholas and Marta had been told he never married their mother. One more sin that would have to be explained. In his head, Dmitri asked Rosa, "What should I do?" She would have known how to fix this, just as she had smoothed over every family argument through the years. But there was no reply, because she was in the cold earth. He telephoned that night, and Nicholas answered the call.
"Won't you meet me, son?" he begged. "We need to talk. Please, let me explain."
"I don't care about your private life, Dad," he said wearily. "Nothing will bring Mom back. I can't come out tonight because Patty and I are flying to California in the morning, and I'd like to spend the evening with my grandma."
"What about your sister? Is she there?"
"Marta and Stanley have gone back to their place. I'd leave her to calm down a while if I were you. She's taking it hard."
Dmitri couldn't stop trying, though. The day after the funeral, he drove to Marta's house with Rosa's jewelry box. Stanley opened the door, but refused to let him in.
"Please," Dmitri begged. "She's my daughter."
Stanley was immovable.
"She's been telling me some horror stories about her childhood, about how you used to beat them both, and to be honest, I'm surprised she didn't disown you long before now. She kept her feelings to herself because she didn't want to hurt her mother, but now she says she just wants you to leave her alone."
Dmitri was surprised by the accusation. Didn't everyone smack their children?
"I'm the first to admit I wasn't a great father, but surely I deserve a chance to explain myself. Tell Marta that her mother knew about my relationship with Tatiana,
She had always known.
I don't reckon that's going to help somehow.
Stanley folded his arms.
It don't make it right that you went to see her before Rosa's body was cold, when your own children needed you.
I thought they were asleep.
There was no sense in arguing with this pig-headed man, who seemed to have positioned himself as Marta's new protector. Dimitri begged to be allowed to see her, but Stanley would not budge. Eventually, he handed over the jewelry box.
"Will you at least give this to my daughter? She should take what she wants and send the rest to Nicholas's wife."
Stanley tucked it under his arm. "I know there are more things she wants from the house. Perhaps you can make yourself scarce while she collects them. Tomorrow afternoon, maybe."
"Whatever she wants, she can have."
Dimitri agreed, and he kept to his word, going to spend the day with Tatiana. On his return, he looked around, trying to see what was missing. A few ornaments here and there, a painting, some kitchen items. He didn't notice till much later that Marta had taken the old brown leather suitcase in which he kept Tatiana's diary. Rosa had begun to store the family photos in there, not realizing the significance of the diary at the bottom, not realizing that suitcase dated from a time before he met her, when he was still searching for Tatiana. Asking for its return would only inflame the situation, so he let it be. He hoped that Nicholas might be able to intercede with his sister and placed a call to California one evening, but Patty came on the line and said he was too drunk to come to the phone. She was worried about his drinking, but supposed it was just his way of dealing with grief. Patty promised she would have a word with Marta when she spoke to her next, but did not sound particularly optimistic. Dimitri and Tatiana often discussed the estrangement, but they could find no solution. When his children's birthdays rolled around, he sent $1,000 checks, which he was pleased to see both of them cashed. He wrote telling them he planned to sell the house, which was too big for him, and asking if they wanted any furniture, but there was no reply. In truth, he couldn't bear to live there anymore without Rosa's warmth. In the old days, they used to gravitate to whichever room she was in, whether she was cooking, ironing, or sewing by a sunny window. She had been the center of the home, but now it was just a series of rooms without any focus. He moved into Tatiana's cottage, but her garden was not big enough for Trina, a lively dog who needed a lot of exercise. One day, while they were walking by Lake Akanabi, they spotted a cabin for sale, and straight away Dimitri wanted it. The location was stunning, at the remotest end of the lake, not overlooked by any other properties. He went to the real estate agent and paid cash for it that afternoon. It was just four walls and a roof, but he hired a carpenter to build a covered porch and a dock sticking out into the lake. He got it plumbed into a well further up the slope and had a septic tank and bathroom fittings installed. Tatiana chose a bed, a table, a sofa and armchair, a thick rug and curtains, pictures for the walls. A pot-bellied stove gave off enough heat to cook, to warm water and keep the interior cozy. And Dimitri bought a fishing rod, planning to fish from the end of the dock.
"Is this the equivalent of a hair shirt?"
Tatiana asked as she bathed in lukewarm water on a frosty autumn morning.
"I hope you are not trying to do penance for your sins by coming here." "No."
He shook his head.
"I want my life to be simpler. I'm 64 years old and I've had enough of other human beings. Apart from you, of course." "I'm not sure I can stay here all year round."
Tatiana laughed.
"It's beautiful. But I shall keep my cottage for the months when bugs fill the air and torment me with their bites, and for the winter when it is impossible to get warm."
Dimitri had written to his children, giving them his new address, and when Christmas came around, Patty sent a Christmas card. He telephoned from Tatiana's house to thank her and to ask if there was any news.
"Marta's pregnant,"
she told him.
"Her baby is due next April."
Dimitri was moved.
"Perhaps, with the arrival of the little one, it might be a good time for me to try and make the peace."
Patty hesitated.
"I've tried, but she simply refuses to talk about you. She has a very one-track approach. Her mother was a saint, and you were a sinner. I don't think Stanley helps, to be honest."
Dimitri sighed.
"And you?"
he asked.
Are you and Nicholas happy? He's still suffering from the loss of Rosa. I don't know how to snap him out of it,
Patty confided.
But I'll keep trying.
Tell him that he still has a father, and that I'm here if he ever wants me.
Dimitri had no advice to give her, because he realized he hardly knew his adult son, could see few similarities between him and the little boy they had raised. It didn't occur to him to pass on the advice that was helping him through his own grief. Solitude, long walks, and the beauty of the outdoors. In February 1956, on the first anniversary of Rosa's death, Dimitri wrote heartfelt letters to both his children. He described his own strict upbringing back in Russia and apologized that he had been an emotionally distant father. He had tried to be different, but somehow the childhood influences were too deeply ingrained, and he found himself acting in ways that reminded him of his father, for which he was sorry with all his heart. He told them about the losses he had suffered during the Russian Civil War, including the disappearance of his wife, Tatiana, and the bouts of depression he had battled ever since. He tried to explain his sorrow at having to leave his homeland. It didn't look as though he could ever return now that the communist regime was so firmly rooted. It was even possible that Russia and America might try to blow each other to smithereens with their deadly atom bombs. He told them that he and Rosa had loved each other dearly and had been good partners to each other for over 30 years, and he explained that she had known from the early days he was already married to Tatiana and had accepted the situation, had even wished them happiness after she had gone. Finally, in his letter to Marta, he wrote, "I know I have been a failure as a parent to you, but I did the best I could. I hope with all my heart that I will be allowed to meet the grandchild you are carrying. Please know that I love you deeply, and will always be here if you want anything from me." From Nicholas there was no acknowledgement. Marta's letter was torn into tiny pieces and sent back to him in the original envelope, marked, in Stanley's handwriting, "Return to Sender."
Chapter 62. Brno, Czech Republic, the 16th of October, 2016. As she sat in Stansted Airport, waiting for her flight to Brno, Kitty listened to all the voicemails that had filled her phone. Most were pleading messages from Tom, left early in the summer, and there was a long, heartfelt one from her friend, Amber. "Kitty, I'm so sorry you found out about Tom's fall from grace the way you did, and I wish to God I had told you straight away. It was complete fluke that I saw them together in a bar in King's Cross Station when I was collecting my mum from the train. It was obvious they were more than friends, so I charged up to Tom and yelled at him. To give him credit, he was mortally ashamed, said he had made a huge mistake and begged me not to tell you. He promised it was over. In fact, he told the woman in front of me that he wouldn't be able to see her again. She shrugged and didn't seem bothered, so it's not as if it was some big romance. I told Tom I would be watching him like a hawk, that he needed to sort himself out, and if he put a foot wrong again, I'd be on the phone to you faster than he could pull up his zipper. But in retrospect, I should have told you anyway. We girls should stick together. I'm sorry for getting it wrong. I just didn't want you to be hurt. Please call me Kitty." Her flight began to board just at that moment, so she quickly texted Amber. "I'm an idiot and don't deserve a friend like you. Going to Brno for a few days. You'll have to Google it to find the correct pronunciation, as I had to. We'll call and tell all on my return." She took her seat on the plane and was about to switch off her phone for takeoff when a message came back. "I love you. Always have, always will. Text me your return flight time, and I'll collect you from the airport." It was late afternoon when Kitty arrived in Brno and caught a bus to the town centre, then a taxi to the address Hannah Markova had given. It drew up outside an old-fashioned brick-built house that opened directly onto the street. When Kitty knocked, it was flung open by a big-boned woman wearing an apron, who looked to be in her 50s or possibly 60s. She had a ruddy complexion with sparkling blue eyes and short brown hair, streaked with grey. "Come in, come in," she cried, stepping back to let Kitty pass. She gestured for her to go through to an oak-panelled kitchen with windows looking out over a children's play park. Kitty sat down at an oak table, scarred by the scorch marks of generations.
I feel as though we are family, Hannah said, but I can't quite work out the relationship. Welcome to my home. She put the kettle on to boil and produced a plate of apple cake, although Kitty could smell something aromatic cooking in the oven, presumably dinner. It's very good of you to invite me, she said. The mysteries of Dimitri's life have got right under my skin, and I'm desperate to find the truth. It all started when I found this at the cabin. She held out the oval pendant she wore round her neck. A jeweler told me it's Fabergé. Let me have a closer look. Kitty removed the chain, and Hannah held it by the window to examine the markings on the back in the best light. Do you know what this says? She asked. I'm told it is the maker's mark. No, above that. It says Autepo. Kitty was none the wiser. What does that mean? Autepo was the French bulldog that your great-grandfather gave to Grand Duchess Tatiana back in 1914, soon after they met. She was nursing him in a military hospital in St. Petersburg. The piece you're wearing is a ludicrously expensive dog tag. She handed it back with a smile. Beautiful, isn't it?
Wow! Was Dimitri her lover?
Kitty's eyes widened. Hannah smiled. They were in love, yes, but they were not lovers in the physical sense as you and I understand it today.
That's why he had Tatiana's diary, then.
Kitty opened her handbag, pulled the diary out of the padded envelope in which she had been protecting it, and passed it to Hannah. I've had this translated into English. If you want to see the translation... No, it's fine. I speak Russian. Hannah scanned the pages, then checked the date on the last page. 14th of July, 1918.
I have the diary she wrote immediately after this one. The handwriting, the style of placing the dates above the entries is the same.
Kitty was puzzled. But she died 2 days after this was written. Did she write another diary in her final days? Hannah offered her a slice of cake, but Kitty shook her head, totally captivated by the story.
Here is the truth that you have flown all the way over to hear.
Tatiana did not die in the Ipatiev house. Dimitri helped her to escape. It crossed Kitty's mind to wonder whether she was visiting a crazy person. There had been many conspiracy theories about the Romanovs, with dozens of imposters popping up through the decades. But scientists had proved categorically that they all died.
Surely that's not possible. I read that forensic scientists have proved the exact number of people who were in the graves, and their heights and ages all fit. They cross-matched bone samples with people who have Romanov DNA, including our Prince Philip. How could the weight of so much scientific evidence be wrong?
Hannah was nodding. She knew all this.
If you've read about the investigation, you'll know how badly the samples were contaminated over the years. What the scientists won't admit is that they kept finding DNA they couldn't match, and they brushed it under the carpet, deciding it must belong to someone working in one of the labs that handled the material. But it didn't. There was another girl in there, the same height as Tatiana, just a local farm girl whose disappearance didn't warrant a police investigation during the upheaval of the times. She had taken Tatiana's place on the 15th of July, and it was her who died in the brutal slaughter of the night of the 16th. Tatiana lived.
Kitty couldn't take it in. So if Dimitri rescued her, where did she go?
Let me read you the story from Tatiana's diary. My father found it in a drawer long after she had gone. It is distressing, but you are Dimitri's direct descendant, and you deserve to know.
She walked across to a sideboard and pulled a tattered notebook from one of the drawers. It was flimsy, unlike the solid leather-bound one Kitty had found in the box of family photographs, but the handwriting inside was exactly the same. Hannah began. Although she was translating from Russian to English, she spoke without hesitation. It was clearly something she had read many times before.
Chapter 63. A Tent East of Yekaterinburg, July 1918.
I asked Vaclav to find me a pencil and notebook, because in the past, writing a diary used to help me order my thoughts. Somehow, I need to pass the hours until I leave this world, and perhaps I should make a record, so that historians of the future will know what became of the last and most wretched of the Romanov Grand Duchesses. It seems incredible that just 5 days ago, Mama, Papa, O.T.M.A., and Alexei
were all together for that emotional service led by Father Staroziev, where he said the prayer for the dead. If only we had taken poison that night and died in each other's arms, it would have been a better end. I don't think any of us had hope any more. The guards were too disrespectful, their behaviour towards us too callous for us to believe we would be allowed a dignified and peaceful exile. But then came that note from Malama on Sunday afternoon, and for a short while hope was renewed. 15th of July, Monday. Papa was concerned about me leaving the house while the cleaner took my place, but he trusted Malama. We all did. She was a sweet girl, by the name of Yelena, and she was terribly nervous as she slid off her blouse, skirt, and headscarf, and swapped them for my gown, while Olga and Maria kept watch by the door. I thanked her for her loyalty and promised that I would see her in the morning. As I walked out with the other girl, Yelena's friend, I saw Anton, the vilest of the guards, watching us, and kept my head down, fiddling with my sleeves, waiting to feel a hand on my shoulder at any moment. Suddenly, we were on the street, and it seemed so bright and open. I was dazzled by the light. I didn't know where to go, but the girl led me to a street corner, and there was my beloved Malama, and he was smiling. Oh, the joy of that moment, when all my fears were momentarily banished. We rode back to a cottage he had rented, and we embraced and talked and talked and embraced, and it was beautiful. I loved him more than ever that afternoon. Such sacrifices as he has made for me could never be repaid. I didn't want him to leave the cottage that evening. Perhaps I had a premonition of what was to come, but he was confident of his plan to rescue us all. So I bolted the door, and while I waited, I looked round at Malama's few possessions, his spare clothes, the meagre bread and cheese in the kitchen, his tooth powder and brush, and I loved them for being his. Oh, I would give anything to leap back to those moments, the last moments of innocence. I heard horses approach, and the door being rattled, and I ran to hide in the wardrobe. Why there? It was the first thought that came to mind. There was nowhere else. With terror, I listened to the sound of the door being hacked down. Then there were men's voices in the cottage. The wardrobe was pulled open, and when I saw the ugly, pockmarked face of Anton the guard, I knew I was doomed. He grabbed me by the hair to pull me from the wardrobe and spat in my face, calling me prostitutka and all kinds of awful words. I ordered him to let me go, and he slapped me, then threw me to the ground. He didn't care if I was hurt, had no concern about what my father might say. "We followed you here, you and your boyfriend," he said. "Did you really believe you could get away? You royals think you are above the law." He tied a dirty rag over my mouth so I could not scream for help, and secured my wrists behind my back. When he hauled me onto his horse's back, I assume we were returning to the Ipatiev house. At that stage, I was not afraid for myself, but for what they would do to Malama if they caught him. The two men riding alongside did not look at me. They seemed to take orders from Anton. I suspect it is because he is a bully, and they are scared of him. When the horses stopped, it was not at the familiar house, but outside some dirty hovel. Anton pulled me from his horse and shoved me hard in the back to force me inside. There was no one in the street, nowhere to run. It was dimly lit, but I could see there were two rooms with straw mattresses on the floor and little else. Anton pushed me into one of the rooms and shut the door, and I stood there shivering, deeply shocked. Malama would be back at the cottage soon. What would he do when he found me gone? How would he ever discover my whereabouts? If only there had been time to write him a note, give him a clue. But it all happened so suddenly. I could hear the men drinking next door, their voices becoming increasingly raucous, and I wondered when Yurovsky, the commander of the guards, would arrive. I would appeal to him to return me to my family immediately. When Anton opened the door, he laughed a truly evil laugh, and I could feel how much he despised me. All those times I spoke haughtily and reprimanded him had sown a deep hatred, and now he wanted his vengeance. He hit me hard across the face, knocking me backwards onto the bed. Then he fell on top of me, ripped at my clothes, and violated me. The pain was indescribable, his rancid smell utterly repulsive. But worst of all was the thought of Malama, my husband, and what it would do to him if he ever found out that his precious wife was no longer pure. I can't bear for him ever to know. 16th of July, Tuesday. While Anton slept, I crept up and tried the door, but it was locked and there were no windows. I could feel blood between my legs, where he had ripped me open, and a dull ache in my belly, as if he had damaged something deep within. I could see from a chink beneath the door that it was dawn outside, and worried myself sick thinking about poor Yelena, the cleaner. If I could not get back to the house that morning, she would be stuck inside, and my family would be terrified for my safety. Why had Anton not taken me there? Did Yurovsky know of my escape? For all that he was unsympathetic to our plight, I could not believe he had condoned this brutal attack. Anton must have planned this on his own and persuaded his two cronies to help. I decided that when he woke, I would be nice, pretend to like him, and try to persuade him that I would tell no one if he would just take me back to the house. I had worked the rag off my mouth by now, although my hands were still tied, and as soon as he woke, I spoke kindly, using terms of endearment. My attempts did not persuade him for one moment, though. He violated me again, then tied me securely, feet as well as hands, before leaving. The hovel fell silent. I rolled to the door and nudged it with my shoulder, but it wouldn't budge. I knew Malama would be looking for me and couldn't bear to think of his distress. What would he do? Where would he turn? I tried everything I could think of to get free during those long hours, pulling and twisting my ankles and wrists until they were bleeding. I was raked by savage thirst. And when I drifted into sleep, I dreamed of cool, clear mountain lakes and woke even thirstier than before. The light faded, and now it was night again, with no chink of light coming from the outside. Anton and his friends returned, and I realized this must be the house where they slept. He was drunk when he barged in, swinging a lantern that made me blink, and then he said the most hateful words in the world. "Your family are all dead. And it's your fault. By trying to escape, you signed their death warrants, and tonight the executions were carried out. How does that make you feel?" He tore the rag from my mouth, wanting to hear my reaction, and I screamed as hard as I could from deep down inside, and only stopped screaming when Anton hit me on the head and knocked me unconscious. 17th of July, Wednesday. The next morning when I awoke, Anton had brought me a glass of water, but I knocked it over. I wouldn't take anything from him. "We are going to make a little trip today," he said. "I thought you would like to see where your family died before you joined them." And it may sound strange, but I was comforted by this. I believed him when he told me they were dead, and all I wanted was to join them in the hereafter. The sooner the better. "You must behave as I tell you when we reach the house," he said. "Or else I shall bring you back to this place and keep you here as my slave to use as I wish. Remember that." He wrapped me in a long cloak with a hood, which was stifling in the summer heat. Then we rode through the streets until I could see the Ipatiev house. My heart was beating hard. Might Malama be somewhere nearby looking for me? Might Anton have been playing a trick and my family was still alive? The guards were not at their usual posts, but two of them were sweeping the yard, backwards and forwards, in a scrubbing motion. Anton took me in through a side door, and down a flight of steps that led to the basement. 23 steps, I counted. "This is where it happened," he whispered, and straight away I could smell the salty metallic scent of blood. It turned my stomach. Anton had his arm through mine and dragged me along to a storeroom, and as soon as I saw it, I felt faint. Someone had tried to clean up, but there was so much blood that their efforts had only served to smear it across the floor, up the walls. In places, it had congealed into dark lakes. "This is where they died," Anton told me. "Your mama had a chair in the middle here." He stood on the spot, and little Alexei beside her. My knees were collapsing, and I leaned back on a wall as Anton demonstrated where each one had stood. I could feel their presence in the room and sense their terror, their screams. And then he told me that the girls had been slow to die, so they were slashed with bayonets. And he showed me the slash marks in the floor, the bullet holes in the wall. And there was a buzzing sound in my ears. I must have collapsed, because suddenly I was lying in the blood, and it was all over me. The blood of my parents, the blood of my sister.